This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. After I moved to Vermont, I took a tour of the Vermont History Museum in Montpelier. What really caught my attention was the display that explained that Vermont was the first state to abolish slavery. In 1777, the framers of the Vermont Constitution wrote, "No male person born in this country or brought from oversea ought to be holden by law to serve any person as a servant, slave, or apprentice after he arrives to the age of 21 years, nor female in like manner after she arrives to the age of 18 years, unless they are bound by their own consent after they arrive to such age, or bound by law for the payment of debts, damages, fines, costs, or the like." I couldn't be more proud about the progressive decision made by the Vermonters of the late 18th century. With one bold stroke, slavery ended in Vermont. If only it were so. As we know with history, there's always more to the story. Much more. Here to focus and discuss what really happened with slavery after the signing of the state constitution is UVM history professor Harvey Imani Whitfield. He's the author of a new book called The Problem of Slavery in Early Vermont, 1777 to 1810. Imani Whitfield, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start by defining what the word slavery actually meant at the time in Vermont and in the rest of the country.
Sure. I think legally it would just mean chattel bondage. Somebody who is held as a slave and the law backs this up and their children can be enslaved. And that person's labor is controlled or controlled by their owner. Now, we shouldn't take that to mean that a slave doesn't have his or her own dignity or his or her own agency or a way to fight back against being a slave. But it means basically that you had, for the most part, depending on what we're talking about, either very few or no legal rights at all. Your labor could be stolen from you. You could be bought and sold like an animal. And people controlled your children and they controlled your freedom of movement. That's slavery in a nutshell. But it's also, you could give a more complicated definition as well.
Did the abolition provision in 1777 then have any effect in Vermont?
Of course. Of course it had. It absolutely had an effect because we do know certainly that there were adults who were freed. I mean, there's no question about that. The problem is one of enforcement of the law, right? Enforcement. In the loophole that left children enslaved, right? And that's the big issue. So certainly some adults were able to gain their freedom. But the question for me is what adults were left in slavery and what children were left in slavery? And I think that that's sort of where my study goes.
Excellent. And did our Constitution, Vermont's Constitution, then have any effect beyond our state? Did other states look at it and say, now there is an actual constitution that abolishes this? We should follow suit?
I think certainly people were aware of it. Now, how important it was to them, I think, is another question, because, of course, Vermont was this sort of, in the eyes of certain other states, this sort of rinky-dink republic that was actually just a part of New York. But certainly, do I think it meant a lot to abolitionists in other states who were able to author gradual emancipation legislation, whether that be in Rhode Island or Pennsylvania, you know, or Connecticut or other states? Absolutely, I think it's there. So the impact is there. And I have to be very clear about it. My book is not about denying the importance of the 1777 abolition provision. The point of the book is actually to say what else was going on, that when you end slavery, it's just not a paper law like the 13th Amendment that said slavery's over. You have to ask yourself what's going on the ground. And from what I could tell, in some ways, slavery in Vermont, just like every other northern state that adopted emancipation or gradual emancipation, slavery still continued on the ground in some ways.
And let's talk about that. Why did slavery still exist in Vermont post-1777?
Or how did it exist? I think partially because it wasn't enforced. You know, in many ways, they simply did not enforce it. Also, you know, for example, owners of slaves just sort of subverted it, ignored it. In many ways, a good example of this is with black children. So if you could hold a black female slave until age 18, You know, so you would hold her, get domestic labor out of her for a certain amount of time. And then by the time that she came up to be freed, what would you do? Well, you could sell her out of the state. And that's exactly why the state passes the Sale and Transportation Act in 1786, which admits that instances of you know, black people being re-enslaved and sold outside of the state. And it makes sense from the perspective of a slave owner. We also want to understand, what were these slave owners thinking? I mean, if you know that the state is going to take away your slave, something that you've invested in financially, you've got, I mean, if you're a good-hearted, let's say, evangelical Christian in 1779, you might, yeah, I need to free this person. Or if maybe you're worried about your financial interests, you sell the slave outside of the state.
Now, that was just one of subsequent laws after the Constitution, right?
Right.
What was another law that had to be passed?
Well, that's the thing that I think we need to focus on is in 1777, the abolition provisions passed. In 1778, the legislature forms a committee to study slavery and make sure it's agreeable to the Bill of Rights, but they don't pass a bill. So in other words, people knew immediately there wasn't enough there, that the wording was a little weak, you know, that there was a lack of enforcement, loophole for children to be enslaved. So, yeah, so I think those are all sorts of issues.
Listeners, does the revelation that slavery persisted in Vermont for years after the state constitution abolished it surprise you? What do you know about slavery, and what do you want to know about slavery in early Vermont? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your comments on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Now, in pure numbers, do we have a sense of how the population of slaves in Vermont changed from 1777 to the early 1800s?
Yeah, it's very hard because the sort of census information we have is very fragmentary, especially for 1777 and then in 1780s and then to 1791. I think in 1791 there's between 269 to 271 black people. I think in 1770 maybe there's 25 or 30 black people in the state, maybe by 1780 50 or 75, but we don't know for sure, and we must always remember that census are notorious for undercounting African Americans, for undercounting slaves and free blacks for that matter. So I think that's very important to acknowledge.
I don't want to jump ahead too far, but when can we safely say that there were absolutely no slaves being held in Vermont?
Right, and this comes back to your previous question. There are all these sorts of laws. You have the 1786 Sale and Transportation Act, and then in 1806 you have probably what I think is literally the single most important act that's passed, and that's an anti-kidnapping act which says there are still people enslaving black children as late as 1806 and selling them outside of the state. This is in 1806. And then in 1810, I also found a few examples, two examples of slaves in the 1810 census that a very famous Vermont historian, T.D. Seymour Bassett, had found. And I double-checked on his work, and he was absolutely right. And I think it could go even until after 1810. There are some people who think they're picking up scattered examples, because sometimes black people are referred to as servants. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't slaves. So that's it's sort of unclear. So maybe 1810s, you know, we might be able to say that that's when slavery ended. But the fact that they have to pass a law as late as 1806, which acknowledges the amount of enslavement that's still going on 30 years after the 1777 abolition provision, that's something really important.
Pretty telling.
Yes.
In practice, was slavery in Vermont different from slavery in the South?
Well, yes, and it was different than slavery in other parts of New England, I think. I mean, it's different because obviously there's not a cash crop, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't need the large numbers of slaves you would have in a place like, say, South Carolina, where you're with rice, or Maryland and Virginia with tobacco. So you don't have large gangs of slave laborers. So you have very specific parts about Vermont slavery that you can find in other parts of the Northeast. For example, if you're an owner, you probably own only one slave, maybe two. Right. So small holdings. And when slaves are in a household with a white family, that means basically all their interactions are with this white family. It's not sort of a large slave plantation with old master's house up on the hill and hundreds of slaves. It's much different. So a Vermont slave. So say, let's just say a Vermont slave living in Springfield in 1778 would be sitting there, you know, eating with her owner, cleaning the house, probably working in the on the farm, doing all sorts of things, but socializing together. So it's a very sort of close slavery that historians have come to call family slavery.
And so they had kind of more of a life than in the South. So kind of describe what their day might be like, what the life of a slave in Vermont in the late 1700s, early 1800s might actually be like.
Well, I think it would be very tough, and I'm not sure. In some ways, you can make an argument that it was better than slavery in the South, but at least in slavery in the South, you would have other black people around you who you could form a family with or have friends with and create a community. I think a black person living in Vermont that was a slave, if they're lucky, they might be able to find a partner, a lover. They might have a friend. I think that it would consist of waking up early and doing small farm slavery. Everything that we know about small farming in Vermont in the late 18th century, your days would start very early and they would go very late. You would be cleaning floors. You might be shoveling snow. You'd be cooking meals. You would be doing child care. I mean, I think for black slaves in the North, as many historians have pointed out, you're on call 24 hours a day. So while in some ways slavery in the North is not the same in terms of, say, the brutality of a place like slavery in the Caribbean on a sugar plantation, there's still work, and their labor is still being exploited. So I think it's an important point to make.
I'm speaking with Harvey Imani Whitfield. He's the author of the new book called The Problem of Slavery in Early Vermont. Listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a call now from Judy in Fayston. Judy, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, excellent eye-openers these are for how things were a little bit different in Vermont, but not very good. One of the things that I and others have thought, the film 12 Years a Slave, I think for people who don't understand this generation and others who don't understand what really slavery involved, all high school students perhaps should see this. Everybody should see this film because it was slavery elsewhere and to a degree, a little degree here, because of the incredible, the definite need for equality. The wonderful, it's wonderfully intelligent, this film, and is a that, too, is a real eye-opener for those who don't understand what slavery was.
Great. Thanks, Judy. Have you seen the film, and what did you think? Accurate depiction?
I thought it was a very good film. I thought the depiction was very intense of Solomon Northrop's life. I took my senior seminar, which was called The Problems of Slavery in Western Society. I took my entire class to the film, and they really enjoyed it. I think it did a really good job of depicting different types of slaves. Because as I tell my students all the time, we tend to dehumanize slaves. We tend to treat them as one big, great black mass, as if they're not individuals, as if they don't have their own ideas, their own thoughts, their own personalities, their own complexities. And so I think that the film did a good job of doing that.
Mm-hmm. How did you determine that slavery was still occurring in Vermont after it was outlawed in 1777?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I want to say that there has been a lot of other historians who have done great work on this subject, including some of my friends, Kari Winter, Elise Guyette, Ray Zerblis. These are all people who have done a lot of work. And I think, so I had known from the provision that it was a little sketchy, that it's just freeing adults. I wondered what else could be out there. And that's when I looked for more government documents, and that's when I was able to find a few bills of sale of slaves, you know, including one which is so depressing. It's a little boy named Anthony who sold in 1790 by his owner, Jotham White, who was a member of the legislature, by the way, to New Hampshire. He sold it to his brother-in-law, and then his brother-in-law sold this little 7 or 8 year old boy up to Quebec. Can I just say one thing? I just want to add something here. The reason why I love this topic and the reason why I love Vermont history is because of the complexity and the nuance. I mean, if you're a black person, you're living in Vermont in the 1790s, you could own property. You could take a white person to court. You could serve in the militia, at least until 1793. And you could have all sorts of opportunities that you might not have in other parts of American states in the 1780s and 1790s. But at the very same time, you could be kidnapped or re-enslaved. At the very same time, your child could be held as a slave.
Well, the Constitution allowed for those things for a black person. But how close was that to reality, to someone living here, an African-American living in Vermont then?
That's a great question. I mean, I would say for that little boy, Anthony, it was very close. For another bill of sale for a girl named Rose in 1783, she was 14 years old, and somebody bought her in 1783. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, there is absolutely no way this guy's going to free her after paying this amount of money 4 years later. So for her, I think slavery was very real. And I think slavery was also, you know, very real for Dinah, you know, the famous slave of Stephen Jacob, who would go on to be a Supreme Court judge. So I think for those black people, slavery is real. And we shouldn't discount their experiences. At the same time, if I could just say, we shouldn't discount the fact that there are black people who are freed because of this provision, and freed because there are good-spirited Vermonters like Ebenezer Allen, who frees a woman, Dinah Mattis, and her daughter, Nancy, because, as he says, it is not right in the sight of God to own slaves. So my point is, you have both of these things going on in Vermont in the late 18th and early 19th century, and that's why I love Vermont history.
Let's take another call. We have Lincoln calling from Wheelock. Lincoln, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Yes, I have two questions, if I could. But
sure.
The first being that, did I understand right that the adults were able to be freed, but say if there were a couple, it was very unlikely, but say a black man and wife worked on a farm in Vermont, had children, and then found out they were free or whatever and left, that their children would be left, would have to leave their children?
Would the children remain slaves?
Well, yeah, I mean, if they were under the age of 21 and 18, if we're talking about, say, 1778, 1779, 1780, yes, I mean, that would be something that could happen. The problem, though, if I can just add, is that, so, I mean, if you can hold a child as a slave until 18 or 21, that gives you a form of de facto compensation. Right. You are being compensated. They're saying, yes, you have to free this slave. But here's all the labor you're going to get from this person during their teenage years until age 21, if they're a man. I think that's pretty serious.
And Lincoln, you had another question.
Yes. The other one was how impacted were the slaves at the time when they if at all they did find out they were free? I mean, there wasn't mass media back then, but how. You know, how impacted were they? How when they found out that they were free? Because I read a book where in the South they actually ended up staying on the farms that they were slaves as a lot of times, and working for food that they already got before. So
right.
I mean, there wasn't much. Even though they could own land, there wasn't much opportunity for them to own land or to
Sure.
So there was no money being made. That's like saying you can buy a mansion on the hills, but. You don't have any means of income to buy it.
Imani Whitfield, what were the opportunities once someone was freed?
What could they do? A lot of sometimes they do work as laborers on nearby farms. I think that happens in almost every place where I've read about the end of slavery, whether you're talking about in some parts of the Caribbean, in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and eastern Canada where I've studied, or in other parts of New England. You're right. I mean, I want to make a very important point here. And my friend Kari Winter and I discuss this deeply, is that, you know, there is a big difference between ending slavery, which the founders tried to do, and establishing meaningful freedom. Because what if you're a slave and you're free, as you pointed out, what do you do? What kind of money do you have? You can't buy a farm. You're going to have to labor and, probably do a very cheap labor. So absolutely, how many opportunities do they have? Opportunities are limited, though some people end up doing okay. Lemuel Haynes, who becomes a minister down in Rutland. You could think about Lucy and Abijah Prince. Gretchen Gerzina wrote a great book about them. So there are people who are able to get out of slavery and do quite well. That's a fantastic question. I hope I've somewhat answered it.
Today on Vermont Edition, we're discussing just what happened after slavery was abolished in Vermont. You can join the discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Vermont has a storied history as being a leader in the abolition movement. This is highlighted by the state constitution that outlawed slavery in 1777. But that was not the end of slavery in Vermont. Our guest today, Harvey Imani Whitfield, is a history professor at UVM and the author of a new book that looks at how long slavery persisted in Vermont. And listeners, you can join the conversation today. Is it important to you that Vermont was the first state to abolish slavery? How does the fact that slavery continued change your understanding of the state? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Now, we're talking about the legislature. They pass this constitution. They create a constitution that outlaws slavery. Why? Why take that step?
That's a beautiful question, and it's one of the most exciting things that I try to answer. You know, why do they actually do this? And we have very scanty records. I mean, and I think further research, you never know what we'll find. But my impression is that, you know, there's a few things that are going on. I think that they're influenced, one, by natural rights. They basically say as much. But that can be limiting as well as liberating, because all natural rights does, as Winthrop Jordan, a famous historian, once said, is a negative. Don't abuse people's natural rights. You know, that's not very liberating. So I think natural rights is one thing. Also, religious fervor. I think they wanted to prevent a slaveholding elite in Vermont. I think Randolph Roth is right about that, another historian. I also think it's a way of Vermonters saying that we're different, or at least some of them, that we're different from New York, right? Because what is New York at the end of the day? These people who want to, as Ethan Allen once said, re-enslave us. Well, how can Vermont be different? Well, one way, and this is just pure speculation.
Sure.
One way Vermont was certainly different was New York is the largest slaveholding state in the North. It is an enormous slave population, even as late as 1810, many thousands of slaves. So it's a way to say that that they were a little bit different. The other thing I'll mention, and this is sort of more on the negative side, is that basically I think that, you know, maybe they thought if we end slavery, there'll be less black people. You know, maybe there'll be less black people. Of course, their plans don't work. That wouldn't work out, because in 1780, it's probably like 50, 60, 70 black people here. By 1790, 91, there's like 270. But of course, the population's going up as well. So that shouldn't be too much of a surprise. So, yeah. So I think that those are some of the reasons.
Could there have been an economic motivation in any way? And possibly the fact that it wouldn't affect our economics like it would a state in the South, for instance.
Well, sure. Yes, it's easy to end slavery when, you know, when you are what we call a society with slaves as opposed to a slave society.
Right.
You know, it's a lot harder for somebody in South Carolina to imagine getting rid of slavery, you know.
Yeah. Now, the framers also, they were kind of breaking new ground. They had no legal models to draw on.
Right.
And they left the wording somewhat vague. Is it possible that they didn't realize that it was a vague provision, or were they purposely allowing kind of slavery to persist in the language that they created?
Yeah, I've tried to deal with this. I think there's a few things going on. I think that they are rushed, right? The British Army's coming down, they're fearing for their lives. I think that they're not sure. Their wording leads us to believe that. You know, it doesn't seem in some ways maybe that they considered very deeply the transition from slavery to freedom of the black population. Maybe they didn't think that they needed to. Maybe they thought the population is so small, that's it. You know, and maybe they thought, well, once we free them, they're going to be poor just like a bunch of poor whites, and they're going to have to make it on their own. There could be a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Today on Vermont Edition, we're discussing just what happened after slavery was abolished in Vermont. You can join the discussion by calling 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a call from Simone in Fairleigh. Simone, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi, I was calling to find out anything about Native Americans and slavery in Vermont during this period.
That's an excellent question.
That's great.
So the slaves, were they just from Africa?
No, I don't think they were just from Africa. Maybe there were examples of what she's asking about. I want to be completely transparent and say that my book is about, you know, African-American slaves.
Sure.
And I could certainly, that could be seen as a weakness. I would admit that I do not know enough about Indian slavery in Vermont or what previously had been New France, to make a deep comment on that. A friend of mine just wrote a book about slavery in New France. So I do think that, so I do know that there certainly was that going on in what would become Vermont. I just don't know enough sure. about it to make an educated comment. So I apologize to the caller for that.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call from Emma. She's calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Emma, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
My question is about how we understand Black identity historically, and I'm wondering, Harvey, about your sources when you were doing this project. Were your sources actually coming from Black Vermonters? Do we have an actual documented Black voice? I know you mentioned mm-hmm. Reverend Haynes, but I'm wondering, mm-hmm. you know, are we taking this idea of Black identity on stock from the dominant white voice, or what are our sources from actual Black Vermonters?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it depends on how you want to look at that. I would say, you know, you can have a sensitive reading of sources that are created by what you referred to as the dominant culture, and you can get out of that Black voices. I would say that some of my work on Black people in other parts of the United States, in Maryland and Virginia and in Nova Scotia, I had to get Black voices, Black identity out of white sources, right? And I think that that's an important thing to acknowledge, that, you know, you can do a sensitive reading of sources that might elicit something like that. As for your question, where do you see Black voices? You know, that's a great question. I think, you know, one thing that I would suggest that we have, that where we can try to get those voices out of, are people like Lemuel Haynes that do leave a written record. Jeffrey Brace, who Kari Winter has gone over that, John Salant's book on Lemuel Haynes. So there are Black voices. And sometimes I would add to you, there are Black voices in even slave advertisements. I think people have done a lot of work on that. And I found that in my stuff on Vermont. There's one slave advertisement of a runaway slave. I think he was from New York. He was in Vermont, and his owner says, you know, this person is very intelligent. He speaks this way, and he follows the tradition of being a doctor in Vermont, right? So he's telling you how people see this person, but also what this person is sort of showing other people. So I think there's many ways to do that. So I think I think what you have is a great question there, but I think you can find aspects of Black identity and what you're referring to as some dominant cultural sources. Of course, we want direct Black voices, but I think part of being a Black historian, and I should mention I am African American, so I'd like to think that I'm somewhat sensitive to this, is, you know, being able to take a lot of other sources that might have been read in one way 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, mm-hmm. and try to read against the grain and try to elicit Black voices from that. If we go beyond things like Lemuel Haynes' writing and Jeffrey Brace and so on and so forth.
Let me follow with a question from Chris in Enfield, New Hampshire. And Chris asks, I'm curious what sort of education were slaves entitled to, if at all?
Oh, well, I don't know about entitled to, if I would
or
say.
Or did they receive?
I think in New England, you know, New England is quite well known for slaves being taught the Bible and being taught some forms of, you know, literacy. It's not anything great, you know. They're not going to Middlebury or UVM or University of Vermont, but there are some pushes towards that in New England. There are, as you know, in the early 18th century, people who want to open schools for Black youth and so on and so forth. So they might not necessarily have an absolute legal right to it, but it's certainly being done by many slave owners, and even in the South, some slave owners will teach their slaves to read as well.
Well, let's take a look now at, after 1777, who were holding these slaves?
Mm. Well, I think that's, to me, that's one of the things that's sort of hard as a Vermonter to deal with, because unfortunately, they're not exactly what they're, you know, they are the elite in many ways of Vermont society. In other words, everyone knows that they're doing it. Moses Sage was a wealthy businessman in North Bennington. He certainly owned a slave, and everybody knew it. Another person who I would say seems to have owned the most slaves and sold the most slaves is Jotham White, very well-to-do in Springfield. You know, member of the legislature. I mean, is a powerful person. Stephen Jacob, of course, is the most notorious example. Somebody who will eventually be on the Supreme Court. He's on the Council of Censors. He's in the legislature. The people who own slaves, they're not just sort of these, you know, these sort of like recalcitrant, like, you know, a lot of times they're some of the most powerful and well-to-do and respectable people in the state. And everyone knew that they were doing it. And I think that's important to acknowledge.
Let's take another call. Richard is calling from Stowe. Richard, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question or comment?
Very interesting show. Thanks for being on. I was wondering if there were any lawsuits brought by any of the slave owners back then when the government passed this law, if this was considered a taking by the government and that they had to make compensation for this taking.
Wow, great question.
That's a great question. I think, and this is something I've talked about with many people, we're only starting to go through the court records right now. The court records are being sort of brought back to the Vermont State Archives. And I think this is a research project that I've been considering doing, but it would take an enormous amount of time for us to go through the actual county court records to find these little cases. I would make the argument to this person that, you know, in allowing people access to black child labor, you're sort of cutting off some of the the possible lawsuits. And I think, though, to find out more about lawsuits, I think there'll have to be further research done. But that's a great question.
Now, I just can't understand exactly how Vermonters who kept slaves could square that independent spirit that was evident in this state with the fact that they were denying another individual their independence. How is that possible?
Well, I think, you know, there's many ways that they do it. I think one way is that, you know, that if you've allowed yourself to be a slave, you don't have any virtue. You don't have any bravery. If you read the writings of Ethan Allen, he always says, you know, if we're brave, if we're courageous, if we are, you know, then we will enjoy freedom and riches and so on. But if we give in to the New Yorkers, we will be enslaved and we basically deserve it. And of course, when famous American patriots say talk about this sort of thing, you see a very similar outcome. So, yeah.
And how does one neighbor who has no slaves allow, you know, look blindly at the fact that their neighbor keeps slaves?
I think perhaps they thought it was none of their business. Perhaps if it's somebody like Stephen Jacob, this is a very powerful person. And what are you going to do if you're just a local farmer who Stephen Jacob's probably lent you money before, right? I mean, I think that, you know, you have to remember that in the late 18th century, the idea of ending slavery for many people was really fanciful. So,
Harvey Imani Whitfield is a professor of history at the University of Vermont, the author of a new book, The Problem of Slavery in Early Vermont, 1777 to 1810, comes out next week. You have a book signing as well next Thursday, February 6th, 4:30 at the Vermont History Museum that's in Montpelier. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much, and thank you to all the callers. I appreciate it.
Coming up, a salmonella outbreak from peanut products in 2008 caused a Vermont boy to become severely ill. His mother is now meeting with members of the Vermont Congressional Delegation to discuss food safety. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. The Federal Food and Drug Administration is currently finalizing rules for the new Food Safety Modernization Act. Gabrielle Minier is a resident of South Burlington whose 7-year-old son became ill from a salmonella infection in 2008. She's in Washington, D.C. this week to meet with members of the Vermont delegation about the Food Safety Modernization Act. Gabrielle, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Rick.
Your son, Christopher, was one of 700 people sickened by salmonella poisoning in 2008. How did that salmonella end up in the food he ate?
There was a company called Peanut Corporation of America, or PCA for short. That company was purportedly knowingly distributing food across the U.S., and further, food products, meaning peanut products and peanut butter, peanut paste, in 4,000 different products. Christopher was poisoned in particular by peanut butter crackers. But if the question was, how did it happen, the company had several errors in the way that they produce their product and didn't correct these errors.
Was it easy to determine exactly what food product it was he had eaten that caused it?
That's a really good question, Rick. No, it was not. It was a really painful process to go through. When we were in the hospital and Christopher was diagnosed, first of all, with Salmonella typhimurium, which never heard of in my life, and secondary infection C. diff, which is Clostridium difficile, which is a common secondary infection from antibiotic use. But we had no idea whatsoever what food that he could have eaten that would have impacted him and nobody else that we know, nobody in the family. And we worked with the Vermont State Health Authorities for, it seemed like an eternity to me, but it was over 2 months. It was from November, December into January. And the State Health Department working with the CDC, and as it unfolded, there were, you know, several more serious injuries and illnesses, and 11 people ultimately ended up dying before the culprit, the food product, was actually finally found. At first, they had told me, the health department, that it was the peanut butter in our house, so to confiscate it, and it was not. And indeed, I knew it was not, because I would have been dead. I love peanut butter. And then we were told it was chicken, and so it was a really difficult and painful process to go through, because, you know, these are food products that I knew did not sicken my son, but I had no clue what had, until the Canadians, FSIS, had confiscated some peanut butter crackers that a woman had bought in Maine. And I had heard about that, and instantly the light bulb went off in my head. This is not a food product that's normally in my house and not something I normally serve to my son. But at the time, we did happen to have some peanut butter crackers, and I don't eat them. So finally, it made total sense what the culprit was.
Your testimony several years ago was instrumental in getting the Food Safety Modernization Act passed in the first place. How would this act help to prevent the kind of food poisoning that your son did get?
This act is instrumental in preventing so many foodborne illnesses, because the Food and Drug Administration were acting under the Food and Drug Cosmetic Act of 1938. That was the law that they were acting under. And that law was a reactionary law, didn't have a lot of tooth, did not have mandatory recalls. FDA had no authority to recall foods. So it was clear that we needed, that the U.S. government needed to change the laws on the books for food safety, but it was a long and lengthy process and a very difficult one. So there's infinite ways that this helps us as a culture and will for, you know, I'm thinking, you know, over 100 years to come, because the Food and Drug Cosmetic Act has been in place for so many years without radical changeover. So the food, FSMA is what we call it, the Food Safety Modernization Act, comes from a scientific approach and a preventative approach.
Well, the rules in FSMA have not been finalized yet. The FDA is still working on them, and funding for implementing the bill has not been guaranteed. So do you think this act does have enough teeth?
I think the act definitely has enough teeth. Now, the rulemaking process is difficult. You know, it's been 3 years since the president signed the law, and it's important that it be done right. And I've been watching the FDA and helping the FDA, actually, at public hearings as they lay out and get feedback on the rules. The FDA is hearing the feedback from the food producers, small and large, and working with all sizes of food producers and farmers alike to make sure that the rules make sense and still accomplish the same goal. And that's what's critical here, Rick, is accomplishing the same goal of food safety.
Well, the FDA did hold hearings in Vermont last year about FSMA. Many small farmers, though, are worried that the act would impose regulations that make it impossible for them to stay in business. Do you think that's a valid concern?
I've heard those concerns, because I did go to the public hearing this summer in Dartmouth and also the one in Maine. My response is most small farmers, to my knowledge, are exempt. And I think that we will be very clear, you know, hopefully at the end of the day, as towards who's exempt. And I think that there's a lot of questions on that. But the Tester Amendment exempted most small farms. So I think that there's still confusion over that. But the farms that are subject, I don't think it's going to be nearly as difficult as people think to comply. Now, there are some issues that the small Vermont producer is dealing with, and I'm hopefully that will be worked out in the rules, and it'll be a system that is fair to the small producer. And I think it will be, because I know the FDA certainly heard it.
Does your son still have health problems connected to the salmonella poisoning of 6 years ago?
One of the issues with with foodborne illness or any serious illness, as you can, you know, there comes a point as the years go on that you can't directly pinpoint and say, well, this was a direct correlation. He does have some issues. My feeling as a mother, my mother's, you know, women's intuition will say, yes, that was a direct correlation. He was sick for a long time, Rick, and with some after effects of the illness that were documented directly related. So I would say yes, he will. And my fear has always been, as he gets in an adult, because your gut is so important to good health, what sort of lasting ramifications? And the only thing you can do to say yay or nay is do a colonoscopy. And I did not want that done. You know, he'll be old enough when he gets his first colonoscopy, which, by the way, I think are very important tests to have done.
You're speaking this week with Representative Welch and Senator Leahy. What lessons would you like them to learn from your son's illness?
The lessons learned here, it's hard because ours was a very particular case related to Peanut Corporation of America, where there was a really bad player in the U.S. marketplace, a very bad player, who, by the way, their trial is finally coming into play this fall, to which I will be going down to Georgia to be in the audience. But I would like them to understand that we are all at risk, and, you know, Vermont and any state, for foodborne illness. And it's, you know, one in six of us will get sick every single year, and 3,000 will die. And I'd like to leave a quote that Christopher, he's like a little statistician. And Christopher, from the words of Christopher, he says, that's like the city of, in 14 years, the whole city of Burlington being wiped out. So when you think of it that way, you think, oh, wow, due to something you ate, that's scary. So to our congressional delegations, I thank them for voting for the bill. That was an awesome first step. And I just want to remind them that this is, you know, this is revolutionary, and it's, FSMA needs everyone's support, and it will prevent many more illnesses in the future. And it just makes sense. So we need to support the FDA in their endeavor. We need to fund it. And I just thank them for their support.
And Gabrielle Minier, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
And finally today, folk singing legend Pete Seeger died this week at the age of 94. That sent us digging through our archives in search of tape. Back in 1978, National Public Radio teamed up with VPR to make a documentary about maple sugar making, and Pete Seeger wrote the song we used as theme music.
First, you get the buckets ready, clean the pans, and gather firewood late in the winter. It's maple syrup time. You need warm and sunny days, but still a cold and freezing nighttime for just a few weeks, maple syrup time.
This is the front pan, and the other one is the back pan. And I can show you right here. If you want to look, the gas fumes are gone now. Before it gets too hot, then you won't be able to see. But see those, all those things dropping right down there?
Those rods?
Yeah. Well, they are, they're fluid. They're just, that's the raw sap is right in there.
Yeah.
And what does, the flame goes right through them, and that's where you get most of your evaporation, is in your back.
It has to get hot enough to boil.
Yeah, she'll really start boiling here and get a good fire in. It'll be hot. Get held up to the light here so you can see it. Here's the fancy right here. This is A, and this is B.
Now, that's entirely by color.
Yeah, that's the color. That's just the grade of it.
This grade's got nothing to do with the way it tastes.
Nope.
So you got fancy, A, and B.
Yeah. And some, I don't know, this over here is going to make B, because it's been setting so long, see, that it's... Because the quicker you get this in this raw sap into syrup, the better off you are. Because, you know, it'll start to sour.
Boil and boil and boil and boil it all life long. When what is left is syrupy, don't leave it on the flame too long. But now seize the minute, build a new world, sing an old song. Keep
Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. Oh, sing it with me now. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. Swing your tail a little bit. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. Clap your hands. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. I wish I knew these words in French. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. Ah, Canadians better learn it in French. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. One more time, everybody. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time.
That was an excerpt from the documentary Maple Sugar Time, featuring the singing of Pete Seeger, who died this week. You also heard the voice of sugarmaker John Hunt of Heartland Four Corners and NPR host Noah Adams. You can find a link to the whole documentary on our webpage at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And that's it for today. Tomorrow we'll take a closer look at how we fund education in this state. Is it time for a new formula? You can share your thoughts by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening.